At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Coming up on the program today, the global economy crude oil department. How much is your data worth anyhow, and is there a way for you to know? Also, some really good bread. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York City today, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, June the 24th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Crude oil is where we begin today, and we dig in with this observation. The U.S. benchmark West Texas Intermediate, it's called, closed today up 0.8% at $57.90 a barrel. You will understand why we start there when I remind you that WTI, as it's known, rose 10% last week amid rising tensions and a little bit of shooting in the Strait of Hormuz. You will also understand why we start there when I tell you that President Trump took to Twitter today, shocking I know, to pose this question about the Strait of Hormuz and the Persian Gulf. Why are we protecting the shipping lanes for other countries many years for zero compensation? The president wants to know. Well, Marketplace's Andy Euler gets us going with this reminder that it's a global economy.
Last year, 21 million barrels of oil per day flowed out of the Strait of Hormuz. That's according to the Energy Information Administration. But these days, less than 10% of that comes to the U.S.
Still, U.S. is importing some oil from Middle East, but the dependency is not that significant.
Sarah Vakshuri of SVB Energy says that reduction in oil imports is thanks in large part to fracking, boosting domestic oil production. She says a disruption could cause a slight uptick in gas prices here. There's a reason they call it the global oil market. But for China, Japan, and India, it could result in a legit energy shortage. That's why Vakshuri thinks this administration has some leverage.
They're suggesting why our taxpayers should pay for security of oil that goes to India or to China. They need to contribute, but I don't think they're suggesting that U.S. should totally leave the Strait of Hormuz.
Trump did write that, quote, all of these countries should be protecting their own ships. It's unclear what the consequences would be if the U.S. did pull out of the Strait.
This is a very, very wide expanse of waterway that's never really been blocked or appreciably slowed.
Tom closes with the Oil Price Information Service.
Removing it as a viable sort of waterway to move oil would take extraordinary circumstances, and we haven't seen those extraordinary circumstances really ever.
He says oil traders and the news media may be exercised about the Strait, but in the end, he expects we'll be paying about the same prices at the pump this summer. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
In healthcare today, some transparency, perhaps, in healthcare costs. President Trump has signed an executive order directing the Department of Health and Human Services to force hospitals and medical offices to disclose the prices they charge and whatever out-of-pocket costs a patient might have to pay themselves. So in theory, you'll be able to know how much your, say, hip replacement is going to cost before the bill shows up. How's it going to work in practice? Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
A few weeks ago, 31-year-old Elliot Nadler of New Jersey woke up with a sore throat. He went to a walk-in clinic to get tested for strep. He knew he'd be paying out of pocket because he's got a $5,000 deductible.
They, took my blood pressure and then took a strep test, came back negative. I got a bill in the mail for $140.
More than he expected. He says the clinic never told him he'd be charged for the throat swab and a basic exam, or what the whole thing would cost. Rice University health economist Vivian Ho says right now, healthcare pricing is opaque.
Competition is based on the ability of consumers to see prices, and we just don't have that.
President Trump's executive order aims to make those prices visible, though the details of exactly how haven't been worked out yet. Martin Gaynor at Carnegie Mellon says allowing consumers to compare prices will help control healthcare costs to some degree, but
this is not like buying a quart of milk or gasoline at the pump. Transparency can only matter for services that people have time to choose, where they can plan in advance.
Gaynor says for something like surgery you need right now, it can be really hard to shop around for the best deal. Some insurers and healthcare providers warn that revealing confidential price agreements could undermine competition and actually end up driving healthcare costs higher. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street this Monday, decidedly meh. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All kinds of companies collect all kinds of personal data on you, their customers. Hopefully that is not news to you, their customers. Those companies then sell or trade or otherwise use that data to target ads at you and thus make money. That particular slice of this digital economy usually happens without consumers having much detail on what exactly is going on, other than that their data is being used somehow. But perhaps that will not be the case too much longer. Today, bipartisan legislation was introduced that would force the biggest companies, we're talking those with 100 million users or more, to tell you exactly how much your data is worth to them. The way it would play out is that you'd get a report every 90 days telling you how much value you are trading for your email address or your Facebook feed or what have you. In theory, that's great. In reality, well, you know, there's reality. Molly Wood is the host of Marketplace Tech, to whom we turn on stories and days like these. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
All right. So look, give me the practicality thing first here. Are these companies with gajillions of users going to be able to do this at all?
Yeah. You mean the reality part? I mean, it's very debatable. Creating individualized reports at this level would be hugely difficult. A lot of companies are going to say, look, we anonymize, you know, we've been promising you all this time that we anonymize this data after we collect it. And so it might not be possible to tell you at an individual level or per company or per transaction or per advertiser or the value of your data as an individual versus, you know, what happens when it's aggregated with a bunch of other people's data who are just like you. And so I think these reports could end up being a little vague, like maybe these companies add up the number of users and they divide by ad revenue. In fact, Facebook does a version of this already.
Do you suppose they could narrow it down to say, I'm a, you know, suburban white dad of X number of years and here's how much, you know, in theory, you people are worth to us?
Most likely. So most likely it could be either this huge number or sort of like this is what your demographic is worth. And that would provide some visibility, but it's probably not what these senators are going for.
Okay. So if it's not practicable, then, you know, other than the political hit on this thing, what are the senators who introduced this bill looking for?
I mean, I think the theory is that there is value in quantifying something, and that value can come from educating consumers who, you know, may have no sense whatsoever how much value their data actually provides. And if you can force a company to create a value and put it on paper, then you can use that value to drive lawsuits and legislation. So you have this more honest transaction, and maybe you set up a scenario where people get paid for their data, but more likely you're able to say, all right, great, you have now shown us how much this data is worth. Here come the laws.
Do you actually think though that people are ever going to get paid for their data? I mean, for reals.
Well, you know, I mean, that certainly is a proposal in California, but I have to be honest, I sort of recently became aware in talking to some experts that even if I'm getting paid for my data, I'm still locked into a system that I have no say in. So it's sort of like, thanks for the $5, but when do you think the beatings will stop? I'm actually, you know, like it's not the right answer. I'm way more interested in the parts of this bill that would force companies to let me control my data, know what's being collected, and hopefully even delete it. That's what I'm about. Delete it.
Yeah. Super, super quick. Realistic or not realistic to think this gets anywhere?
I think some version of it goes somewhere. It looks a little like our GDPR, and I think that definitely has some legs.
Right. The European privacy law. Molly Wood, the host of Marketplace Tech, and also, yeah, also with me, a podcast we do where every now and then we do this kind of data privacy stuff called Make Me Smart. Molly, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus, and its name is Toys R Us. Bloomberg reports the remnants of the once iconic, but then a year or so ago bankrupt toy company is going to open up about a half a dozen stores in time for the holidays. Yes, we are talking that Toys R Us, it of the 800 store closings and 30,000 layoffs. But as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, the new Toys R Us ain't going to look much like the old one at all.
For one, the new Toys R Us stores are probably going to be much smaller, says Sean McGowan at Gateway Investor Relations.
They're not going to be reoccupying the old boxes. The layout's going to be very different. The focus is going to be different.
Toys R Us hasn't confirmed the details, but earlier this year, its executives said they want to focus more on customer service and in-store experiences. That could mean play areas in the store or fun events. Wendy Liebman at WSL Strategic Retail says that's because customers want a reason to walk into the store instead of ordering stuff online.
We want it to be what I would call a deep emotional experience as opposed to a, you know, shelves and walls of things stacked high.
But in the time since Toys R Us's liquidation, Amazon and big box stores like Walmart and Target have scooped up a bigger share of the toy market. And Morningstar analyst Jamie Katz says smaller Toys R Us locations will have a harder time competing with big box stores on price.
Because they don't have the scale with their vendors to negotiate those new prices.
Toy vendors that are still stinging from Toys R Us's liquidation. Gateway's Sean McGowan again.
It is going to be a bit of a challenge to, you know, go back to those same vendors and say, hey, by the way, we'll put the band back together. We've got this new format.
Toys R Us will also have to go back to the hiring pool after laying off 30,000 employees. McGowan says the smaller format simply won't support that kind of staff. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Coming up,
the dough itself is taking up a lot of real estate.
What kind of dough are we talking here anyway? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 8 points today. We'll call that flat, 26,727. The NASDAQ down 26 points, about 0.3%, 8,005. The S&P 500 dipped 5 points, about 0.1%, ended at 29.45. Caesars Entertainment surged 14.5% today after agreeing to be bought by Eldorado Resorts in a deal at $17 billion worth of valuation. Eldorado Resorts sank 10% today. The sale would create the biggest U.S. casino operator by number of venues. Evidence of the Amazon effect today, the giant internet retailer launched its own beauty supply store for professionals, and shares of some beauty products companies tumbled. Sally Beauty tanked 16.7%. Ulta Beauty lost 2.6%. Bonds rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.01%. Hello, Jay Powell. You're listening to Marketplace. And as we approach the end of Marketplace's budget year, we're doing some numbers of our own. Part of being a responsible news organization, especially one that covers business and the economy, is fiscal responsibility. And we've got a target we need to hit by June 30th. We are closing in on our goal of 2,500 Marketplace investors for this drive, but we still do need to hear from you. Even a gift of just $5 will make a difference. So please donate today at marketplace.org. And thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There is, shall we say, an overflowing plate of economic issues that President Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping are going to be talking about at the G20 meeting this weekend in Japan. Right at the top of the pile is Huawei, the Chinese technology conglomerate that by now most people have heard of. Washington says Huawei equipment is a cybersecurity risk and has banned it from most of the American market. It's also making plans to cut the company out of key U.S. component acquisition, too. Huawei is fighting back, in part by inviting reporters to see its headquarters and hear its version of the story. Marketplace's Scott Tong is just back from southern China.
Huawei denies it steals ideas, But its brand new corporate campus in Dongguan, China, does have a certain European feel. During my visit, a fire engine red Swiss train does a 5-mile loop for workers, stopping in town squares modeled after Paris, Verona, Budapest. And inside each old European building is an actual workplace. For instance, a full-size castle, Heidelberg style, houses next-generation research. The message is clear. Huawei is global. Also on the show-and-tell tour, a conference room with a giant screen, where a cybersecurity video describes how Huawei triple-checks its products. Message number two, Huawei defends against hacking, despite suspicions by the U.S. and some allies. But also on this carefully crafted media tour, another clear message, Huawei isn't backing down. Huawei Executive Director David Wang refers directly to President Trump.
We've seen a country's president who can lie constantly. Any actions to smear our reputation will be in vain. Extreme difficulties will unite us further.
There is a fighting spirit in the ranks, too, says Swedish reporter and China expert Johan Nylander. He's the author of Shenzhen Superstars, and he says Huawei workers tell him,
bring it on. We are ready. Bring on the war. We are not afraid. It's like Donald Trump has, you know, given new energy and new power to the staff.
They feel, as he puts it, unfairly targeted.
They've been accused by America for more than a decade of spying. How many evidence has America put forward so far? Zero.
American intelligence is concerned less with evidence than risk that any Chinese firm could be used by Beijing. Huawei not only denies the charge, it throws it back in America's face.
Prison on the wall. Who's the most trustworthy of them all?
Huawei Chairman Guo Ping, at an industry conference in Spain this spring, mentioned PRISM, the U.S. National Security Agency's secret domestic spying program, the one leaked by an infamous ex-NSA contractor.
If you don't understand that, you can go ask Edward Snowden.
Strong words from the boss, but the Huawei workers we met are more guarded. We asked to interview several on campus, and they all back away upon hearing American journalists. But what we do know is what they're reading. Coffee shops at Huawei display an anti-America book that's a bestseller in China. The American Trap is about a French executive jailed in the U.S. Here's Chinese telecom analyst Xiang Li Gang.
The book describes how the U.S. government attacks foreign corporate competitors. It uses the legal system, not market competition.
Indeed, the U.S. has sanctioned Huawei. So the company has to get by without American suppliers. No Google Android software. No Intel chips. Company Vice President Edward Zhou.
If we can survive, later we can say we are a great company.
Huawei's test is to make its own software, its own semiconductors, and show that they're just as good.
Now I think the challenge for us is try to have more transparency. I always said, even internally, we are a telecom company, but we're not so good at communication.
And the world is watching, not so much for the fancy campus, but for evidence that this proud Chinese company can weather American sanctions. In southern China, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Bread lovers out there, among whom I count myself, know of and have perhaps had breads from La Brea Bakery out in Los Angeles, available nationwide, I should say. La Brea turns 30 years old this year, and to celebrate, founder Nancy Silverton is back with a line of special edition breads. She started La Brea in 1989, eventually sold it, and has started and run a whole slew of restaurants since. There is a James Beard Award in there as well. So the other day, out to La Brea Bakery, we went to chat with Nancy Silverton.
Thank you for taking the time.
My pleasure.
Well, I imagine it's a little chaotic for you.
Well, a little chaotic because I'm leaving tomorrow for Italy for 6 weeks.
That's not terrible.
So the good and the bad of it
Right.
But it involves making sure that everybody knows what they're doing while I'm gone. And I'm also in the process of opening up two new restaurants. What a full-fledged restaurant. One sort of a quick serve. There, one by the end of the year, the next one in January.
So look, let me ask you, since you mentioned starting up new restaurants, are you an entrepreneur or are you a chef?
I'm neither. I'm a cook. And
is the chef like a pejorative? Is that just a little highfalutin?
I don't know. You know, I'm so old school. I remember when I first started cooking.
Yeah.
And
you were a kid, right? This is like college or something?
Yeah. A little older than a kid, but in college. But my first sort of serious restaurant job where they gave me a button-down white jacket to wear. And I was like, wow, only chefs wear button-down white jackets. And I never wore one again. So there you go.
You like getting your hands dirty, I guess.
I like to get my hands dirty. I've got a small little empire. I have
no... No, come on. You're like a force. This is radio. They can't see that eye, that side eye you just gave me.
I won't be self-deprecating, but I don't think of myself as an entrepreneur.
Fair enough. That said, you started some things.
I did.
In this town and in the world of food. Bread specifically, which we're going to talk about in a little while, but also just that idea, the kind of cooking you do, was new-ish.
New-ish, but I had my role models, you know, coming from California,
yeah.
Especially up in Northern California, there were a handful of women that were such great cooks, and they really, even back in the mid-70s when I started cooking, they really defied what California cuisine was all about. And that was a style that I adopted and one that I've stuck through my whole career.
Does it feel like 30 years, by the way?
You know, it not only feels like longer than 30 years, just what La Brea Bakery has become. You know, the original bakery was a block further down where, you know, we baked. It sounds like a lot, but it really wasn't. If I said to you, we baked 1,000 loaves a day.
Sounds like a lot,
but that really, in the scheme of things, is not. Now we bake at our two bakeries, you know, one in Van Nuys and one in New Jersey, hundreds of thousands of loaves a day. So it's a little different. And so that part of it seems like, wow, and it all started here in this little space on La Brea.
Let me ask the business question. When did you realize that 1,000 loaves was not enough?
You know, quite early on. Not enough, meaning that the space was not big enough.
Space wasn't big enough. You couldn't, I mean, you have said you can't make money selling bread unless you're doing it at scale.
Well, yeah, we did have a wholesale business as well as the retail business. But very early on, we realized that we needed to move to somewhere a little bigger. You know, the style of bread that we do at La Brea Bakery, the flavor of it and its characteristics are achieved by long, long fermentation periods. So that means that the dough itself is taking up a lot of real estate. To make a lot of money in the bread business is to just, you know, churn those loaves out. But these need to sit. They need to sit and develop. And because of that, you can't, you need a lot of space.
What is it about bread? I mean, you were a pastry chef, and then you started La Brea, right? What is it about bread and that side of cooking?
I think it was Wolfgang Puck that told me taught me pretty early on in my career that the two most important parts of a meal is what you start with, which is the bread.
Sure, the bread and the butter, yeah.
And what you finish with, and that's the dessert. So I was lucky. I had my hands. I was the bookends of a meal, you know?
You, I think it was a talk you gave or something a number of years ago in which you were talking to a group of women entrepreneurs, women maybe cooks, maybe not, and you said, you know, back when I started, there was a feeling that you had to do everything. You had to do everything. And there's a great picture of you with one of your kids who's a babe, I mean tiny baby, and there you are filling out like a menu chart or something.
Yeah.
Right? You know the picture I'm speaking of.
I do, but I wonder when that was.
Well, you know, well, 30 years ago, plus
and
or minus, right?
I have three kids, so it could have been any of them.
But the point is, it was challenging back then. You felt you had to do everything. Do you still think that women in this industry today feel like they have to do everything?
For me to let somebody else do something and back then, and me being critical of it, I only had myself to blame, right? And so in early stages of my career, it was very difficult for me to delegate. I wanted to really have my hands on everything and then be responsible for everything. Right. So I would give something to someone else to do, and I would watch them, and it's like, well, it's not quite square enough, or right. I really think it should go at this part of the plate. And so a lot of times it was easier just to do it myself. But it got to the point that either I had absolutely zero life, or I had to step back, delegate, realize that it wasn't always going to be exactly the way I would want it. But at least it was my choice, you know.
Have you made peace with that?
I have made peace with that until I don't make peace with it. Like when I go in and I see something has gone so awry, you know, then I'm like, and I pull my hair out.
But that's your kind of job now, right?
Yeah.
Quality assurance, right?
Yeah.
You're the keeper of the flame, as it were.
Yes.
Nancy, thanks a lot.
This is great.
Should you have the time and energy, we've got recipes for some of those La Brea Founders breads at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, at the time I almost got to say a dirty word on the radio, but then thought better of it. Today, the Supreme Court struck down a law on the books since 1905 banning trademarks that use immoral or scandalous words. At issue, a clothing brand called Friends U, the letter U, can't trust. Friends U can't trust. Take a minute, sound it out. The First Amendment, the court says, means you gotta issue those trademarks. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrial's basically flat today, up just 8 points. The NASDAQ down 26 points, about 0.3%. The S&P 500 dipped 5. That's about 0.1%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Daniel Shin. Our special projects desk is Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.